Hello and welcome to Tantramar Report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Sackville, New Brunswick, the heart of the Maritimes, on the traditional and unceded lands of the Mi'kmaq people. I'm Erica Butler. It's Friday, December 3rd. Coming up on today's show, Town of Sackville Manager of Corporate Projects, Kieran Miller, joins us to talk about the plans to close down Bridge Street for several days next week and what it will mean for pedestrians, drivers, and several businesses on that street. And we visit the Social Action Fair, which took place on Wednesday on the Mount Allison campus. We talk with one group of students about their presentation on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And then we talk to Sandra Germain, who is the coordinator for the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Social Work Program at St. Thomas University, to find out more about this unique program and its connection to Sackville. But first, more local news and information. Yesterday, the New Brunswick government announced a plan to increase New Brunswick's minimum wage by $2 over the course of 2022. The first raise of $1 from $11.75 to $12.75 will happen in April, about 4 months from now. Then, 6 months after that, in October 2022, the minimum wage goal will go up by another dollar to $13.75. The move should knock New Brunswick out of its uncomfortable spot as the province with the lowest minimum wage in Canada, which Labour Minister Trevor Holder cited as motivation for the move at the announcement Thursday.
We cannot be last in Atlantic Canada. And I'll put it to you this way. A hamburger costs pretty much the same in Sackville as it does in Amherst. And it costs about the same to produce that. And my question is, why would anybody think that it's appropriate that the person serving that hamburger in Sackville is compensated $2 less than the person over in Amherst? It's just unacceptable, and it's time that we moved on and made sure that we weren't leaving New Brunswickers behind.
Currently, PEI plans to raise its minimum wage to $13.70 in April, when most provinces make their annual adjustments. That will leave PEI in the top position in the Maritimes until October, when the second raise in New Brunswick will put this province 5 cents higher at $13.75. Nova Scotia has yet to announce plans for what will happen with its $12.95 minimum wage in 2022. The combined raise in New Brunswick will amount to a 17% increase in the minimum wage by next October. That is still short of what researchers are calling the living wage for the region. A living wage reflects the amount a household would have to earn to cover basic needs and live with dignity while enjoying a decent quality of life. The Human Development Council in St. John crunched the numbers on expenses for a family of four living in New Brunswick's cities. They found that a living wage for the Moncton area would be $18.65 per hour for a full-time worker based on a two-income household. On Thursday, reporters asked Holder about the discrepancy.
I think it's important to note that we have to do things slowly. We have to give businesses the time to be able to react and prepare. Obviously, we've been watching those reports, and I do think this is a very significant step forward. This now puts us on a par with the rest of Atlantic Canada. And from here, I plan in the very near future to start conversations, as I have in the past with my Atlantic Canadian counterparts, about harmonization and how we take steps forward coming out of this. And that will include discussions around a living wage as we move forward.
That was Trevor Holder, New Brunswick's Minister of Post-Secondary Education, Training and Labour, speaking on Thursday. Mount Allison has announced its plans for January, and they include a return to pre-pandemic capacity in the university's classrooms. This past term, the university had a 1 meter distancing requirement in classrooms, still below the typical 2 meter recommendation in most public spaces. The distancing requirement is being removed in accordance with high vaccination rates on campus, frequent facility cleaning, and increased ventilation measures across campus, says the university in a campus update. Mount Allison will continue to require masks in all indoor spaces on campus, in line with provincial regulations. The university made vaccinations mandatory for staff and students in October, with some exceptions for people who are required to be tested twice per week. The university is also participating in the distribution of rapid test kits, with kits available for the Mount Allison community at both the Wellness Center and the Mount Allison Students Union office during regular office hours until December 18th. tonight is Moonlight Madness in downtown Sackville, which includes fireworks this year starting around 6 p.m. behind Town Hall, as well as wagon rides and additional vendors on the streets. And just in time for the festivities, a new shop has opened on Bridge Street. Marianne Oster worked for 5 years at the snack shop on York Street, and when owners Mike and Dawn decided to close in October, Marianne decided to take the plunge and go into business for herself. The shop opened on Thursday in the space formerly occupied by the Vapor Trail, and before that, Thunder and Lightning Pub. I called up Marianne Oster on Thursday and started off asking her what it was like moving into the new space.
Well, we've had it since the beginning of October. We've had to tear down walls, rebuild walls, all that good stuff to make it fit for what we had. It used to be a vape store, so quite a bit of renovations had to happen.
So you've been busy working behind the blue vinyl that was on the windows that whole time.
Yes, we have. Yeah. Yep.
Now I gather in terms of you have the equipment from the old snack shop. Are there also some of the staffers from the old snack shop on York Street that will be joining you there?
Yep, there will be quite a few of them. Still a lot of familiar faces. Yep.
And what about the menu? Will
the menu is going to basically stay the same? We're going to try to keep as much as possible as to what they had.
Okay. Marianne, what did you do before you took on this venture?
I actually worked for Snack Shop.
Okay, so you're an employee who ended up sort of buying the equipment to start her own business.
Yep.
That's great.
Yeah, I had worked there pretty much the full 5 years that they were open.
And you guys will be open, you're open just in time for Moonlight Madness Friday night. Any specials in the works for that night?
Probably. We haven't actually thought that far ahead. We've been pretty busy trying to get opening day started, so who knows? Maybe it'll happen tomorrow morning.
All right. And how was your first day of business, by the way?
Pretty good so far, yep.
All right. Okay, Marianne, well, thanks for speaking with us, and congratulations on your new venture.
Okay, thank you.
That was Marianne Oster, new owner of the Bridge Street Snack Shop, which opened Thursday right beside Quality Grocery on Bridge Street. After a weekend of activity on Bridge Street and throughout Sackville, the street will quiet down considerably next week, at least in terms of traffic. A historic building, the Henderson Building, built in 1900, will be demolished, and to make that operation safe, the town has agreed to close down Bridge Street near the intersection with Main. I called up town senior manager Kieran Miller to find out more about the operation.
Kieran Miller, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Erica. Thanks for having me.
So there's a road closure on Bridge Street next week, which sees some pretty drastic measures, closing a section of the street off to pedestrians and vehicles for 2 days. Can you explain a bit about why there's such extreme measures in that situation?
I'm happy to provide a bit more explanation around it. There's a lot of information, so I appreciate this opportunity to clarify that for residents and business owners. So we're saying that there is a street closure starting on Monday, December 6th until Wednesday, December 8th. So what that actually means is that at noon on Monday, the section of Bridge Street between Main and Lorne will close to vehicles. So we'll get the detour fences up, but pedestrians will have full access to go up and down Bridge Street. And Beal & Inch, who are the contractors doing this project, will start setting up the construction fencing. Then on Tuesday morning, December 7th, they're going to extend the fencing across the street. And the reason that we have to close down the street and there won't be any through access is it's a very complicated teardown. The building in question is kind of in the middle of the block, so it's got buildings attached on both sides. It's quite a high building, it's tall in height, which makes it complicated for the teardown, as well as the age of the materials mean that the bricks are very prone to shattering when they fall. So in order to protect any pedestrians, any nearby buildings, any businesses, they have quite a large demo area just to kind of have that fall zone to make sure that if these materials do fall, no one's going to get hurt by them, no businesses are going to get damaged. So that's where that's why the closure is being planned the way that it is.
Can we expect boards up, like, across the street to sort of protect those buildings across the street?
So Beyond Inch is planning to have the construction fencing with screening. They may be considering boarding a couple of windows up. I don't know if they have to have it across the street, but I think they are considering it for buildings attached to the building that's coming down.
Now, is this something that Beyond Inch would have applied to the town for permission to do?
Nope, this is a project being completed by a private landowner. It's tied to the building was damaged in fire in September 2020. So they're in the process of the property owner is finally taking the building down that was damaged. So it's not something that they would need permission from the town to do. But they are working with the town on the road closure, where it is our road that's being closed.
Right. I'm just wondering, like, in terms of for Beyond Inch to close the road, they would have had to get a permit from the town to do that. Is that right?
Not a permit specifically, but they would have to work with the town on the closure.
Okay. All right. I noticed in council, a lot of road closures go through council, particularly, you know, even Moonlight Madness, there's going to be, you know, this Friday, there's going to be some road closures having to do in preparation for the fireworks. And those are typically approved at council. This one did not go through council. Is there a different procedure depending on who is asking for the road to be closed?
Basically, we have two types of street closures. We have operational ones and event ones. So, for example, Moonlight Madness or the Chalk Festival, those would be events, and those type of street closures go through council. Whereas an operational street closure, such as the Bridge Street closure happening next week or Queens Road, those types of closures are operational. They're based on repairs that need to happen. So those types of requests don't need to go through council.
Okay. So have you heard complaints from people? I mean, as this is sort of rolling out, I'm just guessing that people are going to be, you know, slightly upset that they won't be able to get through Bridge Street to Main, and pedestrians are going to be asked to go through the independent parking lot as their detour, I gather. Have you heard from people yet about this plan?
We've had a couple of concerns raised by business owners on Bridge Street, just wondering what the actual impact is going to be. So if you look at the site plan we included on our post, all the businesses outside the demolition area will be accessible throughout the entirety of the project. And there's about three businesses that are within the demo area that are going to be impacted, and we're working out a plan with them on how they can operate. So some of them might choose to close for the day. Some of them are going to have revised or limited operating hours and be accessed through the rear. So we'll be posting that information next week. Some of those businesses are still kind of working out what is going to work best for them. But we are trying to support them through this. Obviously, it's Christmas. It's an important time of year for retailers. And we are trying to make this as painless as possible for them. As mentioned, all the other businesses on the lower half of Bridge Street will be accessible throughout this whole project. And the actual demolition that Beyond Inch is doing, they are doing everything they can to do it as quickly as possible.
Okay. So I guess the businesses that we're talking about, Ducky's and Fenner's Place and Ada's, and it looks like the demo area just begins right after Songs. Is that right? Am I reading this map correctly?
So Ada's entrance wouldn't be impacted. So the three businesses that are impacted are Meraki Beauty Lounge, Fenner's Place, and Ducky's.
Okay, so Ada's does have access there.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so I guess we have to stay tuned to see how people get into Meraki, Ducky's End, and Fenner's Place if they do it all for a couple of days next week.
As mentioned, those businesses are still kind of working out what is going to work best for them, and then we'll post that information early next week.
I'm surprised that they're not just able to build like a cover the sidewalk. Even when they're building like skyscrapers above you, they just sort of have like that scaffolding style coverage of the sidewalk.
Yeah, so that scaffolding type, like the covered sidewalks you see, that's for like a long-term construction project. You know, it's a significant piece of infrastructure, whereas this street closure, we're hoping it's like 24 hours. The date of the 8th, like we're saying that the street is going to be closed from noon on the 6th until the morning of the 8th. Ideally, they can get it all done on the 7th, but we're just, it's a conservative estimate. We don't want to tell people the street's going to be open before it might be. Hopefully, we can get it open earlier, but just given the time frame of the project, it should be quite short. So the solution it was determined that was best was just to close it down, keep people safe. We don't want, you know, a big group of spectators watching just because of the potential for, any debris to hit anyone. So it's really a safety issue in this case.
I gather then on the 8th, it might not be a full day closure.
That's correct. Day one, the street starts closing at noon, and it's really about setup. Day two is when the bulk of the demolition and construction work should take place. And then day three is hopefully just finishing anything that needs to be done, tying up any loose ends, and getting the construction fencing out of there and the street opened again.
Okay. And those days will be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, weather permitting.
Weather permitting. We're keeping our fingers crossed.
All right. Okay, Kieran. Well, I appreciate you telling us a bit more about this. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Erica.
That was Town of Sackville's Senior Manager of Corporate Projects, Kieran Miller. Next up on Tantramar Report, we're going to take a trip to a social action fair held on the Mount A campus on Wednesday. It might surprise you to find out that in addition to a couple thousand Mount Allison students in Sackville, the town is also home to a small group of St. Thomas University students, if only for a week out of every month. Students in the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Social Work Program at STU don't actually study in Fredericton, but rather gather with their professors in a more geographically central location, Sackville, to do their intensive studies. The program takes 3 years to complete and graduates about 20 students each year. One of the courses sees the students researching a relevant social issue and presenting to the public as a way to educate and inform about Indigenous experience. While in previous years, the resulting social action fair has been hosted in Fredericton, this year the students set up in Tweedy Hall on the main floor of the Student Center. I dropped by to check out the fair, and here's one of the groups I met.
My name's Keisha Bernard. I'm one of the students for the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Bachelor Social Work Program. I'm from Eskasoni First Nation. We decided to do our project on the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, LGBTQ2S. And our goal for our presentation is to help spread awareness, advocate, and also to promote action.
Missing and murdered Indigenous women, I mean, we have, cases all over the Maritimes and Atlantic Canada. Is this something that's, affected you personally?
I feel like we all are affected personally because, Indigenous women are three times more likely to be victims of violence, and so as an Indigenous woman, I always feel like, I have to be on guard and I have to be careful because, you just never know.
I'm Caitlin Nash. I'm from St. Mary's First Nation. We're focusing on relationships, so you know how there's red flags in relationships, like the bad. We're focusing on the good because we feel like some First Nations youth, especially female youth, they don't know about the green flags and relationships. So we wanted to focus on like spreading awareness about the green flags so they know what is good and what is bad so they can vacate the situation if they would need to.
Interesting. So focusing on what you should invest in.
Yeah.
What are some of the green flags, would you say?
Like the person supports your personal growth, respects your boundaries, and compromises when necessary, so they compromise to like your needs. And in healthy relationships, people can feel safe, respected, and accepted for who they are, and we want to honor that and spread awareness on that. With the Silent Witness Project in New Brunswick, they do silhouettes of Indigenous women that were murdered by their partner for domestic violence, and we have Rowena Sharp here from my reserve, St. Mary's First Nation. I knew her personally. I grew up on the same street as her and was best friends with her children growing up. It was really nice having her. It's really nice having her here because like we get to honor her spirit.
Where is this silhouette kept normally? Where did you guys have her with you?
It's kept, yeah, we borrowed her from the Silent Witness Project, which is in Marysville, okay, in Fredericton. Mm-hmm.
So a little bit more on the Silent Witness Project is a traveling exhibit of life-size red woolen silhouettes. Each represent a woman who was killed by a current or former husband, partner, or acquaintance. Because these women no longer have a voice, the silhouettes are called the Silent Witness. Each figure bears the name of a woman who once lived and worked among us.
I'm Tori Solomon, and I'm from Tobik First Nation, Nagukuk. A part of our project is raising awareness of how this is a systemic issue. It's a really time for action. The numbers, the statistics, they've been going up and up. And it's just, at this point, there needs to be the adequate services. There needs to be places for our women to heal so they don't find themselves trapped in situations that are, you know, harmful to them. So that was just another big part of our project, is talking about how like so systemic issues have caused our women to go missing and murdered, like to be missing and murdered. You know, a lot of times women escape one bad situation to find themselves in another, just trying to survive. You know, that could be ending up running with people that, you know, traffic drugs or something, and then they end up in the prison system, which, you know, how that goes. And so it's just really a systemic issue that we also spoke about in our project. Like,
the Social Action Fair is part of the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Social Work Program at St. Thomas University, a unique program with a connection to Sackville.
My name is Sandra Germain, and I'm the coordinator for the Mi'kmaq Maliseet BSW program. And the program was launched in 2005, and that's when we brought in our first cohort. We've since had, this is our sixth cohort that we're going into now, so it's been about 17, 18 years. And every 3 years in a program like this, we graduate approximately 20 Mi'kmaq and Maliseet students who go on to become social workers and work in their community. And without this program, we would not have all those graduates working in their communities. And we're recruiting for the next cohort already, so it's a never-ending process. We barely have to, advertise, because students are always coming to us saying, you know, can we get in your program, can we get in your program? And it's if anything, we're very under the radar, when in fact, if you really start to look at it closely, it's an extremely successful program. And it shows the students are, for the most part, they're already working in various social fields, but they can't leave their communities and their families for long periods of time. So this program provides for them to come to a central location like Sackville 1 week per month over a 3-year period. and this is something that they're able to manage. So it's the program is designed for mature students that are working in health and social services.
That's interesting. And as a Mi'kmaq Maliseet social work program, does it also, I mean, is there different content than your average social work program?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, we follow St. Thomas's curriculum. The courses are identical. What we do, though, when we have a curriculum committee made up of First Nations people, we take a look at that course curriculum, and we help the instructor to indigenize it. In other words, make it relevant to everything that's going on in First Nation communities. So if you were to walk into any one of our classes, and like you're here now, for example, everything that they're being taught is about, it's relevant to them. And the instructors have to agree to change their core curriculum, if you will. You cannot bring a mainstream curriculum into a program like this without it's almost a major overhaul. It's not a tweak. It's a very serious unpacking of a mainstream course that's being offered on campus. And so far, the students, they just love it because it's all about them. So yeah, we make put a lot of effort into indigenizing, or I call it ulnoizing, which is we're ulno, we're the people, so we try to make the course look and feel and smell like the people. Yeah.
Now it's been, so every 3 years you'll get a new class in, is that how it works?
That's right.
So over the years, that must mean there's a fair number of graduates out there in the world. Do you see that, like how will that affect the program over the years? Will you have, you know, graduates coming back to teach in the program? Like how is that going to...
That's exactly what we're looking at. I can say that we've had over, once this group graduates, we will have graduated about 140 Mi'kmaq and Maliseet students that would never have had an opportunity otherwise. Without the program, many of them are now going on to get their master's degrees so that they in turn can teach in the program. And in fact, St. Thomas is right now in the process of developing a Indigenous master's in social work program. So these students will just automatically, you know, flow into there. And I think we're going to have about 15 to 20 seats per year. And our priority will be the graduates from this program. However, we will take in other First Nation social workers that have graduated from the mainstream program as well. So yeah, there is a continuation for sure.
Building up.
Yep.
All right, well, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was Sandra Germain of the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Social Work Program of St. Thomas University. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar Report for this Friday, December 3rd. As always, we hope you'll get in touch with your comments or questions at news@chmafm.com. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.